everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, the challenges of renewable energy and the need for a paradigm shift for a post-growth economy. My guest from Santa Rosa, California, Richard Heinberg. Richard is a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute and is widely regarded as one of the world's experts on our shift away from the reliance on fossil fuels. His writings focus upon the repercussions of a fossil fuel-based world economy on food and transportation and the need to transition away from fossil fuels and create a more sustainable future. Richard appears in the new documentary, Planet of the Humans, that is raising some important controversies and was featured in Leonardo DiCaprio's film, The 11th Hour. His articles appear in many media sources like Nature, Yes, Counterpunch, Oil Drum, Public Policy Review, Resilience.org, Project Censored. He has authored over 10 books on oil depletion, energy economics, climate change, and ecological issues. His latest book is Our Renewable Future, Laying the Path to 100% Clean Energy. His websites are richardheinberg.com, that's H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, and postcarbon.org. I'm talking on a telephone today because I'm up in the mountains and finishing up what will be, hopefully, a historic anti-aging clinical study. We've been in quarantine for months, and no one's been off the property, and everyone's dynamically healthy and fit and getting about 7 hours of sunlight a day. And so as I'm on a phone, please excuse the technical quality. It will not be what it would normally be if we were on a microphone. Nice to have you with us today, Richard.
Good to be talking with you again, Gary.
Richard, when you were last being interviewed on this program, we focused on reviewing and critiquing the recent documentary, Planet of the Humans, by director Jeff Gibbs, and promoted by executive producer Michael Moore. Now, our listeners can listen to that broadcast that was aired recently. It's on PRN.fm. But even during the past several days, there has been an avalanche of criticism about the film, mainly from people on the left, ironic, and it's raised a lot of controversy. Now, I consider this actually constructive. We need more honest conversation about renewable energy technologies in order to honestly discuss their real value and limitations. And since our conversation, you have had an additional group of thoughts about the film that you'd like to share, and especially about the vast financial interest in biomass that's a hot thing now and has been for some time, where they're tearing down the forest at a time of global warming, at a time where we need carbon sinks more than ever. The rationale is, we're planting two trees for every one that we cut down. Well, you cut down a tree that took 300 years to grow, and you're planting one that won't be really usable as a carbon sink for at least 50 years. So I don't see the logic of your metrics, I would say to these people. Also, they're cutting down the Amazon, the lungs of the planet, as if that's of no consequence, because Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil, says he wants to open it up to exploration and privatization without thinking even iota for the indigenous people, let alone what it's used for. And behind all this massive scale of exploitation of our environment are governments, the American government, the Chinese government, and the Indian government, three of the top polluters in the world. And with specific emphasis, Richard, I just want to lay this out there. You can address this if you choose to. No one criticizes China for its massive destruction of the environment and its depletion around the world in South America, Central America, Africa, of their minerals. They have the largest collection of minerals in the world. In fact, many of the things that are used for our satellites, our aircraft, our defense industry, our cell phones, our computers, our cars, come from China. On the one hand, China has shown it is utterly indifferent to the consequences of its hegemony. how it gets power. And it's got the Silk Road. And then look at the environmental consequences of both a land-based Silk Road, meaning attaching, well, last time I checked, it's probably more now, about 78 nations are joining in a partnership with China to say, yeah, build us new ports on the ocean, build us new roads and highways, and build us factories. And because China's picking up the bill for this, but it also has enormous amount of control. But the environmental devastation of this is virtually never discussed. We tried finding articles on what is the economic, ecological consequence of the Silk Road of China. Nothing, like crickets. And so what do we do when we look at the three largest polluters in the world, and the largest polluter in the United States is not the Koch brothers, they do their job, the U.S. military, the military-industrial complex, the largest polluters in America, not a word written about this, nothing, no demands, no requirements. So I'd like for you to open all of these venues up as you wish to discuss them as you will. The forum is yours.
Oh, thanks, Gary. Well, that's a lot to talk about. You mentioned China, and this is something that I think Americans in particular really need to think about and take to heart, because we have prided ourselves over the last probably three decades on our ability to clean up our environment. I mean, many of us are old enough to remember when the Cuyahoga River caught fire because it was so polluted back in the, I think it was around 1970, 71, something like that. And the skies over Los Angeles used to be just impenetrably dark as a result of smog. A lot of that we were able to clean up. And we did it, not in every case, but in many cases, by shifting pollution over to China. In other words, China has been, for the last 20 years, burning coal to make the products for us, so that we don't have to pollute our own environment to manufacture them. So that looks good on our scorecard, but from a global standpoint, pollution is actually worse today than it was 20 years ago or back at the time of the first Earth Day. So this is just another situation where it's important for us to think globally. We need to act locally, but we have to think in terms of the globe as a whole and stop sweeping pollution under the carpet, which is effectively what we're doing when we only focus on environmental progress in one country. The other thing you mentioned about biofuels and biomass energy also goes in this category, because in many people's minds, biomass energy and biofuels are renewable. Well, technically they are about as renewable as a solar panel or a wind turbine, but they're not sustainable, and those are two very different things. You can be renewable without being sustainable. What do I mean by that? Well, if you're chopping down a forest, as you say, to make electricity, to burn to make electricity, then that may be renewable power, but it's certainly not sustainable. And this is true of almost all biomass electricity plants, because it takes energy to cut down trees and move them to the plant where they're chipped and burned. And it turns out that within about 100 miles of the plant, it's energy cost effective to do that, but beyond about 100 miles, it's not. So that means that effectively, whenever somebody builds a biomass electricity plant, the within a 100-mile radius of that plant, every tree tends to get chopped down and burned. So that's not a sustainable situation. The same thing with biofuels like palm oil, which is which is a huge crop throughout Southeast Asia, and increasingly so. And of course, it's produced to create a substitute fuel for oil, which sounds like a good thing. You know, it's renewable, but it's not sustainable because the forests that are being cut down for palm oil are ancient, biodiverse forests that are home to immense biodiversity, all kinds of plants, animals, insects, birds. And the palm forests that are planted for palm oil are entirely uniform and regimented so that there's basically no biodiversity, just one species that's been planted to produce produce fuel for human beings. This is one of the challenges of our transition to renewable energy, which is inevitable. You know, the fossil fuels that we're relying on now are non-renewable and depleting, which means that over the next two, three, four decades, we don't know exactly how long, fossil fuels are going to become more scarce and expensive. We've been harvesting them using the low-hanging fruit principle, which means that, you know, that we harvest the cheap, easy stuff first and leave the nasty, dirty, hard-to-get stuff for later. And, you know, after 150 years of extracting fossil fuels, it's already later. The only oil that we're able to add to the world supply these days is oil from sources like the Canadian tar sands or fracking tight oil in the United States, both very costly. Most companies that extract the stuff are losing money. The same with natural gas. Increasingly, coal is becoming more costly to extract because we've gotten the stuff that's close to the surface, and China is having to dig deeper and deeper for coal, and that leads to an increased energy cost of extraction. So we have to move away from fossil fuels also, of course, because of climate change. But what do we move to? That's a huge question, and it's a question that's raised in the Michael Moore film, Jeff Gibbs' film, Planet of Humans. I think the film is flawed in many ways. Some of its analysis is dated. I'm in the film, and the footage they used of my interview in my backyard garden, that footage is from 2009. So, you know, that's old stuff, and I wish they had approached me afterward, you know, more recently, the last year or two.
Second, let's back up there. As a documentarian who's produced over 100 documentaries, I would never take someone's footage that's 9 years, 10, 11 years old, because think of how much has changed in a year, let alone 11 years. Did they call you and say we'd like to use this information in your film, in their film?
Actually, no. The last I heard from the filmmakers was 2009.
So you haven't heard from these people in 11 years, then you find yourself in their film.
That's correct.
That's extremely, in my opinion, extremely unethical.
I was very disappointed at that, because in the intervening 11 years, I've actually researched and published an entire book just on the subject of renewable energy, and it would have been quite relevant to everything that we're talking about in the film. And the research that's in that book would have contributed to the discussion in the film and made it, I think, much more accurate. It would have made what they were saying in the film much less likely to be targeted as inaccurate or lopsided, which it has been, and I think in some cases, rightly so. I was disappointed in that regard.
Well, I also heard, and I haven't confirmed this, that Bill McKibben, who, when I watched the film, it really made him look terrible. It made him look like a shill for corporate interests and the Koch brothers and the big people who wanted to get into biomass. And then we find out later that he wrote an editorial saying that that was 5 years ago. He's changed his mind completely and now actually goes against biomass. None of that was in there.
That's correct. And that's the other problem with the film. The first problem we just talked about, that it uses old material. And the second is that it attacks certain people, I think, very unfairly. And one of them is Bill McKibben. I know Bill, and I've followed his work for many years. And I disagree with Bill McKibben on a couple of issues. But nevertheless, I don't think that he is, taking money from billionaires and altering his views to coincide with, you know, that of billionaire donors. That's implied in the film, but I think it's just simply not true. So, you know, when a film smears someone unfairly, that's very regrettable.
Well, but that's not the first time this has happened. I can give you some other examples, but that's neither here nor there at this moment. What is important is that there's been an enormous backlash against the film, and I think it's time that we had open debates. Let me just digress for a moment. At the last equinox that was celebrated at the UN, I was asked to be the speaker. And it was a beautiful ceremony, first outside, then inside. And I got up and I realized the whole room was packed, standing room only, with people from the environmental groups. And in that moment, it was like a clarion moment. I had an opportunity. I could either give, you know, a nice, you know, a pat on the back to everyone in the environmental movement and how well we were doing, or I could just be completely honest. And I was completely honest. And I want you to follow on this in your own way. I simply said to the group that we have failed. Our individual groups, some of you are worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Some of you have spent the last 20, 30 years living a very nice lifestyle based upon contributions to what people perceived was, if we give to your foundation, then you will do something to help save our environment. And I said, there's no question some of you have been noble in your efforts, but a lot of you in this room have not been. And then I went to a larger picture, the environmental movement. I said, it's terrible when you think that the environmentalists are part of the problem, not the solution. And then I gave very specific examples of some of the issues that will not be touched, will not be discussed, if an environmental group receive funding from that polluter. And I gave very specific examples again of money coming into a group, and suddenly that topic of whatever it is, you know, acid rain or acidification, it's not touched. And then I said, just be really honest with yourselves. How much better is our environment today versus 50 years ago? You know, look at it. And then I took them on a world tour of all the different things, because we've been working on this film that's out now. It hasn't been released to the public yet, but it's really knocking it out of the park. I don't know, did Richard send you a copy of it?
No, I haven't seen it.
I'll see that you get it today. Took us 7 years to write, produce, and film all over the world. Anyhow, it takes you all over the world and shows you all of our environmental problems. And at the end, I ask a basic question. Are we as individuals willing to change our lifestyles in order to save the planet? And this is not an existential issue, because when I was at the last Earth Day, and I didn't go this year, I don't celebrate it anymore, because I found out that we confuse celebrating something that should be momentous if you're winning, if you're changing, if you're making a difference, versus showing up to hear some music, and then they leave, and there's just massive, you know, hamburger wrappers, Coca-Cola cans. You know, there's just such hypocrisy, I can't be a part of that anymore. And then you see people care about the environment and they're eating hamburgers. Well, what part of being a part of the environmental effort are you? So look, please, now at the contradiction between an environmental movement, environmentalists, who are doing nothing personally to show they care. Al Gore is the poster child of that, in my opinion, but he's certainly not alone when Leonardo DiCaprio flew from the Cannes Film Festival to New York to accept an award from Robert F. Kennedy's River Project as, you know, like an environmentalist, and then flies back to the Cannes Film Festival. Then we see them at, you know, on these mega yachts at the Cannes Film Festival, you know, having their Kobe beef or whatever they're eating. It just reeks of hypocrisy. It's like 5,000 people flying in from around the world to Davos in Switzerland and gorging on, you know, the world's premier animal products and flying back without any concept that is there a contradiction, is there hypocrisy here? And I see that everywhere. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah. Well, the environmental movement started out with the motto reduce, reuse, and recycle. And the idea was that it's up to all of us to change and to sacrifice in order to have a planet for future generations and for other species. And that was essentially correct. There have been a lot of criticisms of the early environmental movement that it was, you know, it was too white, it was too male, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, all of that's true. But nevertheless, this clear focus on reducing human impact on the biosphere was there, and it was prominent. Over the years, that has been muted. And it's for a couple of reasons, one of which was understandable and the other maybe less so. The understandable reason is that, you know, back in the day, back in the 1980s, we had a book called 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Save the Earth. Okay, and there was a backlash against that, which was that you know, the things that really need to be done to save the Earth aren't simple, and the average person can't do them. It requires government action. It requires new laws and policies and so on. These are global problems like climate change, and they require global solutions with carbon taxes or cap and trade or something like that. So the environmental organizations, big environmental organizations, particularly in the U.S., started shifting to emphasizing policy and collecting dues and contributions and big donations in order to push for environmental policy. And the message of what each of us can do to help sort of fell by the wayside. You know, what you can do to help is to write a check to the environmental organization rather than taking seriously, you know, your contribution to the problem in how you live. And so over time, this changed the face of the environmental movement. There was no longer a question of what, you know, what sacrifices might be entailed. It became all a matter of the techno fix. You know, if we have the government policy in place, then we will move from burning oil in our cars to driving electric cars. We'll move from burning coal for electricity to having solar panels and wind turbines producing electricity. But you and I will be living basically just the same. You know, we'll be eating the hamburgers and flying to have vacations and all of the rest. It's just that now we'll have a clean climate conscience because we'll be doing it with renewable energy. That seemed like an easier sell to supporters of the environmental movement, but what it did, in fact, I think, was remove the moral authority, any moral authority that the environmental movement had in its early days. And that was a very sad thing to see. I wouldn't say that is true across the board. There were many environmentalists, environmental scientists, and ordinary people who you know kept the faith, who still see their own personal contribution as important, and believe that, you know, how we live, how much we consume, how many children we have, these are questions that really need to be taken very seriously.
Let's go off on one of those serious issues. Since you're familiar with the famous document, Limits of Growth, written over 50 years ago, that warned about the threats of the present capitalist growth model to the climate and environment, how do you see the focus on renewable energies that we're not talking about today, and what will they contribute, like geothermal? We have more than 10,000 viable geothermal sources in the United States, and also wave power. Mm-hmm. We never hear those discussed in any environmental, let's say, environmental progress report about here's where we're going, here's what we can do.
Right. Well, geothermal would be very helpful if we could have more of it. It's a baseload power, which means that it operates all the time. Here, where I live in Northern California, we're getting actually where I happen to live, which is Santa Rosa, California, almost all of the electricity that I'm using, other than what I'm generating from the solar panels on my roof, is coming from a geothermal plant called the Geysers in Geyserville, California. It's great because it is it's base load. It's not intermittent like solar and wind. So it's a really valuable contributor to an overall renewable electricity system. So we need more geothermal. There were some papers about 10 years ago from MIT and a couple of other institutions suggesting we could use deep oil well drilling technology in order to greatly expand the number of potential geothermal sites. Traditional geothermal is limited geographically to areas that are seismically active. That's why we can get it in Northern California and someplace like Toronto, which is, you know, on a very stable geologic region, not so much. Geothermal is not a potential source of power in some place like Toronto. But the idea was if we could drill deep down beneath the Earth's crust, or at least deep into the Earth's crust where the temperatures are much higher, using deep oil drilling rigs, we could pump water down, have it heated, pump it back up to the surface, and create sort of artificial geothermal sites. Unfortunately, that hasn't worked out so well from a cost perspective. There haven't been commercial applications of that technology so far. So it seems as though we may be limited with geothermal to the sort of traditional sites. It may be still too early to tell. Possibly there just hasn't been enough investment or enough research into the sort of deep hot geothermal, but so far has not been commercialized.
Okay.
Wave technology.
Yeah, no, wave technology.
Yeah, wave technology has been actually researched for a very long time. The first proposal for wave power goes all the way back to the 1890s. And a few working systems have been built, but you know, globally, wave power electricity from wave technology is a minuscule, almost non-existent contribution to global electricity. And to scale that up significantly would take a lot more research and development, not to mention investment. And the reason for that is there have been some problems with corrosion. Seawater is very, very corrosive. and with destruction of the systems by, you know, just intense wave activity, super intense wave activity, you know, the storms of extreme magnitude are rare, but when they come, they can be extremely destructive. So again, this is a possibility. It's a promise for future investigation. But right now, wave power is an extremely insignificant contributor to global electricity.
So we're looking at the things that we could do, but one of the things we haven't been able to do, for whatever reason, and I'd like you to address this in some of the ways that this can manifest, is the largest polluter in the United States is the U.S. Armed Forces. There's been no discussion that I've seen in the media about blaming them for being this polluting, the skies, the earth, the oceans, the rivers, the landfills, but also no one seems powerful enough to hold them accountable or to cause any change. Wouldn't that make a difference if we're able to clean up their pollution and prevent it in the future?
Yes, of course it would. And the armed forces have been talking green in the sense of developing biofuels for use in the Air Force for aircraft, and also for the Navy running ships on biofuels. But as we were discussing earlier, biofuels are really not a solution. They may be renewable, but they're not sustainable. Realistically, the one thing we could do to reduce the environmental footprint from the armed forces is shrink the armed forces. Just like, you know, if we want to shrink the ecological footprint, the environmental footprint of civilization, what we need to do is first of all, reduce the amount of energy that we're using, reduce the amount of jet travel that's going on. You know, we're seeing this right now with the pandemic because jet travel is down by 90% because people aren't driving as much. The skies are cleaner. The animals are coming back. The birds are you can hear themselves singing, you know. And no, we don't want this to happen at the cost of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people dying of this terrible disease. But this gives us a glimpse of what we could achieve if we put other things ahead of economic growth. For the last few decades, economic growth has been the be-all and end-all of public policy. And as a result, you know, we've just had our foot on the accelerator of air travel, consumption of plastic, you know, all of these things that are, you know, costing future generations the possibility of a decent life. So we need to back off on that accelerator and find ways of doing it that keep people working, that keep the economy at a level where people are able to enjoy the basics of existence, and when I say enjoy, I mean, you know, happiness should be our goal rather than higher GDP. And happiness can be achieved in lots of ways that don't involve destroying forests, you know, burning fossil fuels, and so on. So, the discussion was about the military. Well, fundamentally, the first thing we have to do is shrink the size of it, and then that will be the main way we can reduce its environmental footprint.
Okay, now for an important discussion is that this goes back some years, and it involves the controlling of the population. And I first heard Ted Turner talking about it. What he believed was a way of saving the environment was to reduce population. And I know that you have specific ideas on this. In fact, this is a common theme throughout the environmental movement, where people say, well, in another 10 years, we may have, you know, another billion people. So if we can't help them, then don't we have some responsibility to start controlling population? So my question is, if that is the topic, why has it become anathema among many environmentalists and the media, as well as the challenge to the world's population growth?
Right.
You briefly mentioned about population is a problem because to sustain a growing population requires more energy and especially more food. And food security today relies heavily upon agrochemical industry that is unsustainable and very dependent upon fossil fuels for fertilizers and pesticides and genetically engineered seeds. That's your Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta. In addition, it is highly polluting of natural habitats and waterways. We can think of the huge dead zone in the Gulf where the Mississippi River empties off, or in Calcutta in India. It empties into the Sea of Bengal where the Ganges empties. And these are all dead zones. Nothing can exist in there. There's no air. And yet you have massive algae blooms in its absence. So the world population is going to increase by about a billion people within 10 years, almost another billion mouths to feed. So what is the solution for reducing population growth? And if our energy and food needs remain at the status quo they are now, then what do you see the ramifications being in another decade if these other billion people are born, especially in light of the fact that the old argument that, well, we grow enough food, it's just not distributed to the people who should be eating it, keeping that is not going to change. The people who have the power over our food, the seeds, the land, they're not going to suddenly become benevolent overnight and decide, yeah, these poor people deserve to exist. I haven't seen that in any of their discourses.
Right. Well, in fact, climate change is likely to reduce our ability to produce large amounts of food. Extreme weather events, whether drought or flood or storms, are inevitable in greater frequency and severity over the next few decades. That's what all the studies show. And that means more challenges to the food system. And here we are, you know, adding another billion to the population. It's actually about every 12 years we're adding a billion people right now. We're adding 80 million people a year on a net basis, births minus deaths globally. And if you think about that number, 80 million people, that's, you know, that's a Los Angeles, a London, a Tokyo, and maybe two or three other big cities. Each and every year, finding enough living space, enough food, clothing, and all the rest to support that many more people. How long can we keep doing that when the results of our way of life are actually undermining our ability to feed even the people that we have right now? It's a prescription for humanitarian catastrophe. So we need to be taking population very seriously. The reason we're not actually goes back, and I just found this out within the last couple of years from some people who were actually there at the meeting. There was a summit on the environment in Cairo back in the 1990s, and at that summit, there was a tacit agreement formed between the environmentalists in the wealthy northern countries and the poorer southern countries. The people in the wealthy northern countries had been talking about the problem of overpopulation. The people in the poor southern countries had been talking about the problem of overconsumption, which is more of a problem in the rich countries. And everyone was getting their feathers ruffled, so they came to an agreement. The people in the wealthy northern countries will stop talking about overpopulation if the environmentalists in the southern poor countries will stop talking about overconsumption. And that agreement has essentially held ever since, right up to the present. So if you're an environmentalist in one of the wealthy northern countries and you dare to talk about the problem of overpopulation, you're immediately painted as an elitist, even a racist, for bringing up the subject. So it makes it very, very difficult to talk about the problem.
Okay, but we're here. You can talk it in any way you want, on any position you want, but tell me how you would control population.
Well, the most effective way that's been found, actually, is to increase the levels of education and social power of women in poor countries. It's very simple. It's not just a matter of distributing birth control, technologies of various kinds, and subsidizing them. Although that helps, but it's changing people's culture and what they're willing to talk about. And often that can be done very cheaply. There's an organization called the Population Media Center, and what they do is to hire creative artists in poor countries, often in sub-Saharan Africa, but in many other countries as well, in South and Central America and Southeast Asia and so on, wherever population growth rates are high, and hire these creative artists to develop scripts for radio soap operas. And these radio soap operas often become very, very popular, where people in villages are coming together every evening to turn on the radio and listen to what's going on in the lives of these characters. Well, in the scripts of these radio soap operas, subjects like a woman's ability to choose whether to have another baby or not, to have a say in the size of the family, or to have a say in how the income of the family is spent, or subjects like this just come up in the lives of these characters and they get discussed. And this, over time, this changes social norms within these societies, and it's been found through very very careful surveys to be the most effective and cost-effective ways of reducing fertility in these societies. And of course, the reason this is important is that in these very poor countries with very high birth rates, the two things are correlated. As long as most families have many, many children, it's very difficult for any one family to save up enough money to educate their children, to maybe start a business, to improve themselves in some material way. Whereas if there are fewer children, it's more possible to do. This is why China has been the economic miracle it has been, aside from burning all that coal. It's because they had the one-child policies, smaller family size. Therefore, each family is able to afford to educate their one or possibly two children, and thereby the economy grows. That's not happening in these
Richard,
poor nations.
I'd like to share my own thoughts, and then you could critique it, all right? I look at it a little differently, and I think that everything you just said is constructive. But when you go into Africa, and of the 54 countries in Africa, they're all, every single one of them, is challenged with income inequality. Even the
the most densely populated countries, such as Nigeria, over 80 million people. Huge wealth to a few who controlled the oil, and massive poverty to everyone else. And South Africa's no different. They didn't follow through with Mandela's changes. They became highly corrupted. So set that aside for a moment. What does the average person want? First, they want what is best for their family. And they're looking realistically what happens when they cannot provide even the basics, sanitation, clean water, for example, and food to cook and be nourishing enough to provide their family with enough so they're not income, or let's say they're not food insecure, meaning they're not hungry, they're not starving, they're not malnourished. And we've seen that. You know, we've seen the child sitting there, the iconic photograph of a pot-bellied, grossly malnourished child. I don't know what it was, maybe from the Civil War, era of the war with Saudi Arabia and Yemen. And a vulture is right behind the child, waiting for the child to die so it can have a meal. As one dies, another survives. So what if you did this? What if you started by having the entire world, all the all of the governments of the world, contribute money to fund social development that would include giving women in particular zero-interest loans to start their own businesses and support them? What was originally started 30 years ago in India, which was very successful, the microloans, but that was ultimately corrupted. Here, you would give people an opportunity to be able to do things that they do, because these are not stupid people, even if they're not formally educated. They're very wise. They frequently have great wisdom, and has been carried down generation to generation. So now you give them an economic basis to establish some more freedoms. Then in every community, you build a water system. It's not that expensive to put wells in and get them past that level where they're getting arsenic out of the wells or toxins, and get them to where they have clean water. Then you start supporting with schools, with quality education, and get good teachers. So every kid has a chance to get an education. Then you start building up the sustainability of their environment. And if they're not sustainable, then help them move to a more sustainable environment so that they're not living, you know, season to season, not knowing if a crop's going to be wiped out because of locusts that happened this year, or drought or rain. So you create a future where they don't have to have more children to take care of them, because that's one of the reasons they have a lot of children. As they get older, they don't want to starve to death, and so they have the children that will be morally responsible for taking care of them. This was also very common in Southeast Asia. That's why the Chinese had the highest rate of savings in the world, about 49%. India's right behind it, because there was no socialized medicine in China. So if you couldn't pay, you know, for your medicines and doctor care, you died. So people save. They still save today. So if we build up around the world, and you could take, you know, take some countries in the Far East, the Middle East, and Africa, South America, and you do tests of this, five-year tests, to see. The deal is that now that you have a capacity over your own life, your own future, you're not working for slave labor in Bangladesh at 14 cents an hour, you have your own business. Now we're giving you, you know, we're putting in a gigantic food or agricultural station that is owned by the village, not by outside corporate interests. So nobody can come in and profit by charging you exorbitant fees for food when you don't have the money to pay, and hence you're in debt peonage, which happens all the time. All you have to do is look at the Congo and the mines for cobalt and other minerals, and the kids are out there because whatever they make that day, that's what food they're able to eat that day. So you build an infrastructure in every community that has a clinic for health care, advice and classes that people must take about how to control the size of their family, by also seeing that if you control the size of your family, you will have a future, and we're there to support you. And again, it's a voluntary basis. If people want to be a part of it, they can. If they don't, they don't have to. But the people that you give the loans to, you have some, you know, conditions there, you know, that do not have another pregnancy if they have a child or two. No more pregnancies for 5 years if you want to be supported. So there's a
there is an effort to educate the public, to empower the public, to give them the resources they need, but in return, they have to be mindful that the reason for this is because with more mouths to feed and less food that is being produced, we don't want to see them starving. People are smart enough to understand this, because right now they have no control over their land, their resources, their sustainability. So that's the first thing that I would do, and that's the best way to put money to work where it will actually help. When you're building clinics, you're building schools, you're building, you know, you're building an agricultural center, hydroponics, aquaponics, because then it doesn't matter how cold or hot, how windy or sunny, locusts or not, you're growing food. Now, I have a background in hydroponics. In fact, we're growing some organic hydroponics right now, as well as we have a sprout house here, and we grow probably 100 trays of greens and microgreens and about 40 different types of sprouts every day. Every day, giant salads filled. You know, we're talking about a gallon-sized salad filled with sprouts. You could do that anywhere in the world if you chose to. So you help a person at that level. You're giving them insight, information, help with their health. You're preventing disease. You're helping them be sustainable. You're giving them water. You're giving them, you know, protection from the environment. You're helping with better structures that are better made so they withstand, not just out of mud and sticks. So that's how I would approach it. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I mean, every one of those suggestions is totally sensible. And it's, you know, in many cases, what we're talking about are just ways of overcoming what sometimes are very deep cultural pressures to increase family size and to keep women's and girls' interests under the control of male members of the household. You know, these deep cultural traditions sometimes die hard, but they're simply inappropriate in a time when you know, population increase. Well, they seemed appropriate perhaps in an earlier age when most children died in infancy or when they were toddlers, and very, very few survived to adulthood. Well,
but Richard, that's what the counselors can do in every village. You meet with your elders. You select the elders that want to be on an elders' guidance council. These are the sages. These are the wise men and women who are not misogynists, who can call out misogyny, who can call out discrimination, who can call out the limitations of historical control in a hierarchical manner. You have that in every village. You have a place where people can go and hold grievance discussions. You give them an opportunity to vent. You give them an opportunity to see that there is a solution that is possible. Right now, that just doesn't exist. So it's not going to be perfect. You're always going to have cultural biases everywhere.
Right.
We have them in the United States. If you're in Orange County, California, you've got them. If you're in San Francisco, you've got them. You know, imagine in San Francisco, you've got as many billionaires, over 200 billionaires, as you do in New York City. And yet you have massive poverty in San Francisco, massive, where businesses now have been told that they cannot arrest or call the police for shoplifting. So needless to say, a lot of people are going to take advantage knowing that they're not going to be arrested for these so-called nonviolent crimes. They go just, and all these stores are going out of business, restaurants and everybody else. You would think with all that power and Pelosi and other people, that's her district, for example, that this wouldn't resolve. Well, we can't even resolve poverty in San Francisco. So therefore, we accept that we have a dual system. We have the richest and the poorest, income equality to the richest, and the inequality to the poorest. So this would be a good example to share with other countries around the world. Don't be the mess that we are, and try to help them. Bring in people who know what they're talking about. That's just a suggestion.
Yeah.
Richard, we're out of time. Any final statement before we sign off here?
Well, just, you know, it's been a pleasure talking about all this stuff because it's not many forums, you know, you can speak openly about some of these issues, and I appreciate what you're doing with your show, Gary, and bringing some wisdom to the airwaves.
Thank you, and let's hope people take advantage of reading Our Renewable Future, Laying the Path to 100% Clean Energy. The websites are Richard Heinberg, H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G.com, and postcarbon.org, postcarbon.org, or richardheinberg.com for additional articles and information. Richard, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Knoll. This has been the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother, I can dig it. Stop right on.